Good evening. It is Friday, February 14th, 2020, and it is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, it's Friday, and so we're kicking off today's show with my first guest. He's a frequent collaborator with all major news outlets and author of City Builders and Vandals in Our Age, Caleb Maupin. Caleb, as always, welcome back.
Oh, glad to be here, as always.
So yesterday, we discussed the New York Times. They have a piece entitled Playing on Kansas City Radio, Russian Propaganda. And part of the piece states, in January, Radio Sputnik, a propaganda arm of the Russian government, started broadcasting on three Kansas City area radio stations during drive time in the United States. Talk radio on Sputnik covers the political spectrum from right to left, but the constant backbeat is that America is damaged goods. Today, in The Hill, it's entitled, Democrats criticize FCC for not taking action against DC station broadcasting Russian disinformation. A group of House Democrats criticized the FCC yesterday for not taking action to curb Russian propaganda aired on U.S. radio stations and urged the agency to take steps to remedy this ahead of the 2020 election. And these are Democrats. They're supposed to be on the more liberal side of the political spectrum. And let me say to you, Caleb, I'm insulted because I'm not a propagandist, nor am I spreading Russian disinformation. And I don't think you are either. You are aligned with RT.
Mm-hmm.
What message is this sending? Your thoughts on all of this?
I mean, it's unbelievable. It's just an attempt to paint anything that could possibly be associated with Russia as somehow fruit of a poison tree, untrue. They don't point to anything on Sputnik that is factually inaccurate. They simply don't like that it exists. And, you know, it's funny. I believe if I get out of radio, I can listen to material from the BBC that would be funded by the British government, that British government that we won our independence from in 1776 and quite a big war. And then there was the War of 1812. And, I can find, if I turn my radio dial, I can listen to French, radio, France 24, France 1. I mean, you know, at this point, if you get out your TV, you can watch Al Jazeera, which is from Qatar, the Qatari monarchy. I mean, at one point, Fox News, which is on the radio and also on TV, was partially owned by a wealthy member of the Saudi royal family in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So this notion that media, because it has some foreign ownership or some foreign sponsorship, therefore is completely uncredible and then should be banned from the airwaves, this is completely ridiculous. And if it were applied fairly, there would be all kinds of things that are not only on the radio, but on television that wouldn't be permitted. I mean, this is particularly absurd. The New York Times has all kinds of ties across Western Europe. I mean, if we're going to apply this fairly to every media outlet, we're pretty soon not going to be able to watch or listen to anything. I mean, it's weird. You know, Steve Bannon and the Trump crowd are often accused of being economic nationalists. But it's almost like they're being economic nationalists when it comes to the media. There should be no media with any international financial sponsorship or backing. I mean, this is a pretty ridiculous argument to make. I really don't understand it. It only works if you have a clear anti-Russian bias in your mind. If you buy this argument that we've gotten from both Democrats and Republicans for decades, going back to the Cold War, that Russia is somehow an evil country, anything that can be connected to Russia is therefore evil. Unless you buy that argument, this doesn't add up. This is simply not logical.
You've mentioned, and very accurately, a number of foreign sources that are owned by foreign governments, but I don't have to go OCONUS outside the continental United States. I can go CONUS, continental United States, and I can look at the likes of Chris Matthews and Chuck Todd at NBC. I can look at Chris Matthews being concerned that if Bernie wins, there will be executions in Central Park. and that this is going to go the way of Fidel Castro in Cuba, that Bernie Sanders will have his enemies executed, and that Chris Matthews could be one. I've got Chuck Todd reading statements comparing Bernie supporters to brown shirts, which one then could extrapolate that being that Bernie is similar to Adolf Hitler. And we've got Joanne Reed bringing on body language experts to explain to us why in the confrontation between Bernie Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren, why Bernie's body language was indicating that his response to Elizabeth Warren were lies. So we don't have to go to Russia. We can just turn on MSNBC.
Yeah, that sounds like quite a bit of disinformation, that you just cited there. And, I mean, who was the owner of MSNBC for many years? No longer at this point. But for many years,
I think it was General Electric.
NBC, it was General Electric, right. And where does Rachel Maddow broadcast her television show from? Where is the NBC media headquarters in New York City? It's in a place known as Rockefeller Center. That's the oil, now ExxonMobil. So to present American media as if it's completely unbiased, completely has no perspective, but these foreign outlets, oh my God. The other thing that's worth noting is if you want to get serious, some people say, well, maybe the private sector has that agenda. But that's separate from the government media that we're talking about. But in the United States, we know for a fact, right, it is a matter of public record that interacting with the media, handling the media, negotiating, talking about, and working to control what goes on the television is one of the primary activities of the CIA, of the Pentagon, and this is very, very well documented. I mean, there's blatant examples of it, right? We can talk about Project Mockingbird, which was revealed, it was revealed by the Church Committee in 1975, but we can also talk about more recent examples. Like, it goes even beyond TV news and radio. I mean, Hollywood, at this point, it's been revealed that the military intelligence agencies tied to the four branches of six branches of the U.S. Armed Services, that they actually sponsored Hollywood movies, right? That that Pentagon money was going to sponsor Hollywood movies that they thought were in the interests of the U.S. Armed Services. Right. And that Hollywood producers were working with members of the military intelligence agencies to write about movies, to figure out what was going to go in the scripts of Hollywood movies. I mean, you can look this up. This is all in the public record. So,
and when you do that, you will find that the father of propaganda, Edward Bernays, was the one who came up with this idea of using Hollywood and using news as a way of forming public opinion.
Indeed, and it's been going on for the longest time. So, I mean, this is McCarthyism, and this is an attempt. If I lived in Kansas City, I would be insulted. I would be insulted. I would say, the folks in Washington, D.C., these top Democrats, think I am so stupid that I can't listen to one radio station, listen to another radio station, and make up my mind for myself. This is a huge insult being laid on the people of the Kansas City area, right? Basically, Washington, D.C. says, we don't think that you have proper judgment when you turn that radio dial. We're afraid that you will hear the wrong thing, think wrong thoughts, and I mean, this is ridiculous. More than anything, I mean, you can talk about Russia all day long, but it's the people of Kansas City, I think, who should be upset by this. I wouldn't appreciate it if someone was telling me what websites I could visit on the internet, what channels I was allowed to watch on TV. Maybe if I was a child, that would be okay, but I am an adult. I have freedom to access information as I choose. I think people in Kansas City, just like people in Washington, D.C., have that same right and should be insulted that people think that they're not worthy of it.
And final point here, we do good work here. That's why you get to hear people like Caleb Maupin on here every Friday, because he does fantastic work and we do fantastic work. And unfortunately, a lot of what we tell you is not what you're being told in corporate media. But more times than not, you're going to say to yourselves, wow, I didn't know that was really what was behind all of this. We don't deal in op-ed here. We deal in straight, hardcore fact and journalism. So let's move forward. Senate passes resolution limiting President Trump's ability to order future strikes against Iran without first seeking Congress's explicit permission. This was a bipartisan vote. It's described by some as a rebuke of the Trump administration's resistance to involving the legislative branch in foreign policy decisions. Many believe that the administration's inconsistent messages and irresponsible actions could lead to all-out war. 8 Republicans joined all Democrats in a 55-45 vote. It was a measure that was presented by Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat from Virginia, which invokes the War Powers Act to block the president from engaging in hostilities without consulting Congress, except in cases where self-defense is required against a clear, imminent attack. Caleb Maupin, your thoughts.
Well, you know, I noticed every State of the Union address until this year's included a very long tirade against the Iranian government. And this year, there wasn't that. All there was Trump defending his decision very briefly to assassinate Qasem Soleimani. And, you know, you have to remember, after Qasem Soleimani was killed, the head of the Atlantic Council, which is certainly not an anti-war or progressive voice by any means, that is one of the main think tanks of NATO, was criticizing that move. And I think that there is a feeling among many figures within the establishment that Trump pushed it way too far with that, that was overreach, right? And that could have resulted in consequences that were very, very, very scary, not just for Iran, not just for the United States, but for the entire world. And that missile strike that Iran conducted against the U.S. base, the whole world was blown away by Iran's military capabilities. We have been underestimating their ability to strike back and retaliate as a country. And Trump said there were no casualties and no injuries. Now we find out that's not the case. Furthermore, we find out that the way that base was hit, if you look at it, Iran could have done a lot worse, and there could have been a lot more casualties and injuries than there were. But Iran made a point of doing it in a certain way, but showing that they had the military precision to carry it out. Like, Trump brought the world to the brink of what could have turned into World War III. And I think that there's a little bit of caution here. And I think that this represents, on some level, an attempt, you know, by some forces to control and restrict Trump's ability. But let's remember that language you just read from it, that it would stop military action unless there was some kind of national security threat. Trump has claimed, I think falsely, that Qasem Soleimani represented some kind of military threat to the United States, and that's why it was carried out. So in theory, even with this passing, even with this piece of legislation, Trump could still claim, based on national security, he had to do something, right? And that is often done, right? We know that, like, national emergencies have been declared against Zimbabwe, right? And that often, in the name of national security, the executive branch will do things that, if you scrutinize them and look at them, it's clearly not a matter of national security. And that there's a lot of things done by the executive branch under that stipulation. Oh, this is a national security measure. And there's many examples of the executive branch overruling Congress in the name of national security, when I think if that were challenged in court, judges would say this is not a national security issue. You have to get congressional approval.
Final point here, because it is anticipated that the president is going to veto this bill out of the Senate. It's interesting to me that the Dems in the House, they passed the National Defense Authorization Act in December, and they removed from that act the bipartisan amendment that would have accomplished a similar end here. Seems to me that in December, the Democrats relinquished their leverage in striking that amendment from the NDAA and passing this week a standalone bill that will be vetoed by the president. Am I right in looking at it that way?
You are very right. I mean, they could have restricted Trump before he took the action. And I think the other thing that needs to be said is, I think that it's very possible that killing of Qasem Soleimani and that escalation with Iran is what saved Trump from being impeached. I really do. I mean, Mitt Romney voted as the only Republican senator to remove Trump from office. But I think it's very possible that Trump had not taken that big, dramatic move and killed that very, very prominent and well-loved figure in Iran, it's very possible that the neocon wing of the Republican Party might have been persuaded to join with the Democrats and remove him. And that, in a way, the death of Qasem Soleimani was Trump securing the vote of acquittal at the impeachment trial. And I think that's very, very possible. And who knows? I mean, we know maybe years from now there'll be documents released and we'll find out about some of the backroom conversations. I'm pretty confident that that's what happened, because that move was very, very, very dramatic. And it certainly was not what Trump campaigned on, about not meddling in foreign countries and focusing on America first. And it was a huge escalation, but it made a lot of forces that were very closely tied to the Israeli government, in particularly tied to the Likud party and Netanyahu, it made them very, very, very happy. Now, let's be real about that.
Caleb Maupin, as always, sir, thank you for your time. Thank you for your analysis and the contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Absolutely.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Four U.S. peace activists, Adrian Pine, David Paul, Margaret Flowers, and Kevin Zeis, a.k.a. the Embassy Protectors. They were arrested on May 16th after staying in the Venezuelan embassy in D.C. for 37 days to prevent it from being handed over to right-wing coup leaders in violation of the Vienna Convention. They are now in trial. I believe that the jury today is deadlocked, and let's get some insight into this from my next guest. He is the founder of the Gray Zone Project. He's a documentarian, Max Blumenthal. Max, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be on.
So again, they were arrested on the 16th of May after staying in the Venezuelan embassy in Washington. What actually were these four charged with?
Well, first of all, before I get into that, let me say that your show and Sputnik Radio in Washington, D.C. on 105.5, it's the only radio station in D.C. broadcast throughout the city that is covering this important trial that has international implications, in which four activists, three of whom are local, are being put on trial for the most absurd charge of interfering with State Department functions when they were told that at most they would be put on trial for trespassing in the Venezuelan embassy. And today we've learned that five Democratic members of Congress have called for shutting down your signal, claiming that it's disinformation, Russian disinformation. Well, there's no disinformation that's being spread right now. It's just inconvenient information. The empire doesn't want any resistance, whether it's from these brave activists and citizens who defended the Vienna Conventions and international law against the takeover attempt by the fake government of Juan Guaido, appointed by Donald Trump, or whether it's by us just simply trying to get this information out. They want to drive everything underground. So this trial is really important. They're facing a year in prison, $100,000 fines each. These are four activists. And the judge, Justice Beryl Howell, who's a Democratic appointee, has done everything in her power to prevent them from having a defense. She's instructed the jury that Juan Guaido is the president of Venezuela, even though he doesn't even control a doghouse. And it's simply because, in her words, elections matter. And she's not referring to the 2018 election in which Nicolas Maduro was elected. She's referring to the 2016 election in the U.S. where Trump was elected. And she says that the U.S. has the right to appoint the president of any sovereign country. So the judge is abrogating international law in this court.
Wait a minute. That's a contradiction to the definition of sovereignty.
Right. She doesn't believe in sovereignty. She says that the only law in the court is the Supreme Court decision, which allows the president of the U.S. to recognize anyone he wants or she wants as president of another country. So if Donald Trump wanted to recognize Mickey Mouse as the president of Venezuela, the jury would have to respect that, according to this judge's orders. And the judge is unable to appreciate or recognize the distinction between a government of Venezuela that's recognized by the UN, which controls its borders and the entire country, and a character who controls nothing, is not even the president of the National Assembly anymore, in Juan Guaido, and is increasingly the subject of international mockery. So that's the situation that the jurors have been put in. These are people who have been subjected to tidal waves of propaganda. You know, I don't know if they listen to Sputnik or read the Gray Zone or alternative media or what, but they are, despite everything they've heard in the Washington Post and everywhere else, where this idea that Guaido is president is pretty much justified, they're deadlocked right now. They've been deliberating for days in a court where there's something like a 97% conviction rate on cases like this, where the judge is constantly trying to steer them in the direction of a conviction. And so the judge, Beryl Howell, is keeping the jurors in court all day and forcing them to constantly deliberate, because I think she and the prosecution, the government prosecution, are afraid of a mistrial. And what I don't want to predict anything, but the jury is very, very confused and not exactly on board with the government's case. And there is a possibility of a mistrial here, which is something that I don't think anyone expected after a few days of seeing this judge in action.
How do you know, or what is it that has given you an indication that the jury is confused? Is it based upon the questions they're sending back?
Yeah, I was in the court yesterday. I'm not able to be there because I'm in New York right now, but the jury continuously appeared to send back questions, and the questions they were asking
were, what the hell are you doing to these people and why?
Pretty much, you know, how do we know that these people were violent or menacing? You know, can you show us emails by Kevin Zeese, who's one of the four on trial, interacting with the Secret Service, demonstrating that he is a nonviolent peace activist? And the judge refuses, of course, to allow them to see those emails, but they're obviously not sold on the idea that these four peace activists could have posed a threat to anyone. That was one question, but there are just so many questions that they constantly pop out of the deliberation room with, and the judge keeps sending them back.
What do you think are the major threats to the government if they lose this? Is it a chink in the armor of Juan Guaido and the proclamation by the United States that he is, in fact, the president? Is it that the empire will be exposed for its egregious action in Venezuela, in Bolivia, in Libya? What do you think are the major things that the government is trying to guard against?
Absolutely. I mean, that was a great rhetorical question. you just named it. And, you know, I think also beyond that, just sort of international embarrassment that a jury of local citizens does not accept the case that Juan Guaido is president, or that these four activists did not have a right to be inside the embassy with the permission of the UN-recognized Venezuelan government, which is the defense's case. So it sets a real precedent for future activism, and it's just it's a gigantic defeat in the heart of the beast for Donald Trump's coup, which has completely failed.
You made the point that the judge in this case, Beryl Howell, is a Democratic appointee. And I think you made that point. I know you choose your words carefully.
Yeah.
Why did you think it was important to draw that distinction?
Well, there are a lot of good Democratic appointees in that court, in the district court. Obama appointees who are formerly public defenders. This judge is not among that cast, and she appears to just sort of be someone who's letting her prejudices show. And I think this is not, you know, a Republican national security hawk, but it's someone who exists outside of the courtroom in our media ecosystem and is subjected to the information war and propaganda about Venezuela just like any other citizen. And, you know, in the court, she's really letting her bias show, for example, referring to the Venezuelan government as the Maduro regime and Juan Guaido and his group as the Juan Guaido administration. And it's that kind of language that you pick up through osmosis when you read the Washington Post or listen to NPR.
Talk about propaganda and talk about broadcasting disinformation and propaganda.
And jury selection was fascinating. I heard from
I got 60 seconds.
Who, several people who witnessed jury selection, one potential juror, said that they believed that there had been two elections in Venezuela and two presidents were elected, one recognized by Russia and one recognized by the U.S. And when the defense attorney asked, how do you know that? They said, because I read the Washington Post.
Max Blumenthal from the Gray Zone, man, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah.
Greatly appreciated. Okay.
Thanks.
All right, Wilmer. All right. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We're back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, it's Friday, so that means it's panel time. And let's start with my first guest. He's an associate professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Tahi. Linwood, as always, welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
We have a political analyst and commentator and editor of The Polemicist. His latest piece can be found at The Polemicist. It is entitled, The Party's Over, Bernie's Last Dance with the Dems, Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Lee.
And we're joined by a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, the Iowa Democratic Party chair, Troy Price, he resigns after the fiasco in Iowa. He became the face of the confusion that swirled around the Democratic caucus in Iowa. In a statement, he said the following: the fact is that Democrats deserve better than what happened on caucus night. As chair of this party, I am deeply sorry for what happened and bear the responsibility for any failures on behalf of the Iowa Democratic Party. He wrote this in his resignation letter to the state central committee. Now that we know, based upon the reporting of Max Blumenthal and others at the Gray Zone about Shadow Inc., an acronym, the hedge fund billionaire such as Seth Klarman, is Troy Price the scapegoat here? Let me start with Dr. Linwood Tahi.
Yes, I think it's obvious that someone has to fall on the sword, and the Iowa Democratic Party chair is the one who was chosen. The other parties to the fiasco, Shadow Inc. and their supporters, including their connection to the Buttigieg campaign, is something that has been in the news. It's been in a couple of news cycles. And in order to put that to bed, at least they think, they have to call an end to this. And this is a way to do this. So there's no doubt that this is a scapegoat. I also think that there's no doubt that this news, that this information will continue to go on and to enter some news cycles, even if it's only by independent journalism.
Jim, following Linwood's point, one of the things that we're being misled to believe is that the Iowa Democratic Party went out and sought this app, but it really appears, particularly since it was supposed to be used in Nevada as well, that the National Party brought the app to Iowa and brought the app to Nevada.
Oh, yeah, it seems that's the case. Yeah, I don't think this came out of Iowa. I mean, this was imposed by the National Party, or at least suggested highly, you know, militantly suggested by them. You know, it's just disgraceful. I mean, we still don't know the results from Iowa. You know, you still don't know the true results from that state. And, you know, we don't know what they were trying to get away with this app. You know, it's a classic example of black box voting, where you have this proprietary software that's running an algorithm that produces results, and you don't quite know how it gets from the vote to the result. And this is coming down from the DNC. So, you know, Price is falling on his sword, as Linwood says, but this is a major problem that's going to be out throughout. That's already, we saw in the elections in 2016 in the primaries, and it's going to go throughout this. They have some other little, whatever it is they're not calling it an app. It's a tool for the iPod, which is an app that they're going to try and be using in Nevada. And there's all kinds of funny business that, you know, if you look at how the Nevada votes are counted, again, there are votes that are, it's a caucus, but there are early votes that come in beforehand that are just announced at the caucus. And you don't know how those were, you can't really see how they got those results. So there's all kinds of funny business that's going to go on. You know, the Democratic Party is going to do anything it can to block Bernie Sanders from getting the nomination. And as the other thing that Linwood said is important is, you know, this is going to be reported in the alternate press. We've seen a bunch of this stuff, you know, but it doesn't come out very much in the mainstream press. And what gets people on a train is the repetition, which you get in the mainstream press about how, you know, Klobuchar is doing so well and Pete is ahead and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And once in a while, they may mention something about this, but they're going to pass right by it and continue on their mantra about Klobuchar is the greatest thing since sliced bread and Pete Buttigieg is ahead and he's going to win. And, you know, and it's the repetition from the mainstream media that holds sway.
Daniel Lazar, same question to you, but adding the point, as Jim and Linwood have said, we saw this movie in 2016. Debbie Wasserman Schultz lost her job as the head of the DNC primarily because of the games they were playing with Bernie then. And so one has to wonder, are they really trying to structure this whole thing so that they get to a brokered convention?
Well, I think one does wonder that, and I think one wonders that with a good deal of a justification. I mean, I think they're scared as hell of a Sanders victory, and they definitely want to slow him down. They want to throw every roadblock they can in his path, and they're worried. And they're worried because of what they call the down ticket effect. The effect on all the senators and congressmen on down to local dog catcher who will be running with on the ticket headed by Sanders, and these are people who all are terrified of the word socialism, and they're going to panic, and the DNC is terrified of some kind of mass panic breaking out if Sanders gets the nomination. So the DNC is really in disarray, but you know. But the DNC has shown itself to be a swamp of right wing, conspiracy mongering and cowardice. So, it's just all coming out right now.
Linwood, to Daniel's point about socialism, to me, this is what a campaign is supposed to be about. If the Democrats actually could construct a message, and if they actually could stay on message, I think they've got enough time to explain to the audience the difference between socialism and democratic socialism and explain to them why single-payer healthcare is a good idea, explain to them why removing the burden of college debt is a good idea, what that would actually do to the economy, freeing up money for people. Because a lot of people that are paying this college debt, if this debt is removed from their record, they're not going to buy yachts. They're going to buy food. They're going to buy shoes. They're going to buy clothes. They're going to buy things that actually stimulate the economy. So this isn't socialism. Democratic socialism and socialism are not the same thing.
That's correct. But the public is not that nuanced. And even then, the public is, there's a recent poll out, I think it's a Pew poll, that says that 75% of Democrats would support a socialist on the ballot, and greater than 50% of independents would support a socialist on the ballot. And by socialists, what we mean is those who are supporters of Medicare for all, those who want to eliminate student debt, those who want a $15 minimum wage, and the other very progressive issues that Bernie Sanders has brought to the fore. So I don't think the general electorate is making a distinction between socialism and democratic socialism, but also the general public is also in support of those things that is part of Bernie Sanders' agenda, that has been part of his agenda for decades. And so I think the Sanders campaign, by sticking to socialism and by connecting socialism to the policies that they support, is making a good case for socialism, regardless of whether it has the Democratic label ahead of it or not. And I think this is, in this sense, there's an uphill battle for the concentric and corporate Democrats to make socialism look like a bad thing.
Jim Kavanaugh, following up on Linwood's point, when we have people like Chris Matthews telling his audience that there are going to be or could be assassinations in Central Park, similar to what happened in Cuba with Fidel Castro, or you've got Chuck Todd calling Bernie Sanders supporters brown shirts. And when you have people like Goldman Sachs CEO, former CEO, Lloyd Blankfein, saying that Bernie Sanders is going to ruin our economy, and if I'm Russian, I go with Sanders this time around. Just nothing but utter disinformation, misinformation, lies, and foolishness. This can't bode well for the Democratic Party.
Well, you know, these are people, yeah, these are Democratic-aligned people who are just showing how lunatics they are. I mean, really, this is, you know, we're going to execute Chris Matthews in Central Park and Carville saying, well, you may be a political hack, but I'm not, at least I'm not a communist. And it's true, you know, what Linwood is saying, this is an issue of socialism. Let it be brought up. Now, you know, I'm one who agrees Bernie Sanders, you know, I would have arguments with whether Bernie Sanders is a socialist. And he's a social democrat. He's an FDR-style welfare state social democrat.
Right.
Scandinavian social democracy. This is not full-on socialism. And, you know, I wish everybody would understand this, but this is not the argument we need to have.
But wait a minute, Jim. Wait a minute, Jim. As much as we love to, we don't have to listen to Jim Kavanaugh. Bernie will tell you that himself. Just listen to Bernie.
Exactly. And what he's doing is the correct thing. He's saying, do you want to have health insurance? Do you want, how many million people do you want not to have health insurance? I don't care whether you call yourself a socialist or a capitalist or a Scientologist. Do you want to have health insurance? Do you want everybody to have health insurance? Do you want to have student loan debt, or do you want to forgive that student loan debt? Isn't that going to work to the benefit of the economy as a whole? These, you know, every other economy in the world, this advanced capitalist economies, live quite well with universal coverage health care. They live quite well with free public education through college. This is not going to destroy capitalism, you know. I mean, and he's capable of having that argument. And the more people try and portray him as someone who's going to be executing Chris Matthews in Central Park, you know, the sillier they're going to look. And I think he'll do very well with this. I'm not afraid of this at all. The Democrats are afraid of it, but I'm not afraid of it at all. I mean, from my point of view, she's muddying the waters about what socialism is, but so what? He's going to do real progressive social democratic reforms that are the real advances for society. And having a debate about this between him and Donald Trump, or in the primary between him and Michael Bloomberg, would be, I think, a good thing that would further make people less afraid of socialism. They're not afraid of it. They may not understand it very well, but people are just not as afraid of it as Chris Matthews and James Carville and Blankfein are. They're saying, I don't care what he calls himself a socialist. I want my health insurance.
Daniel Lazar, what are the takeaways from New Hampshire? What do we now know, or what don't we know going forward?
Well, we know that Sanders did not quite win by the margin the polls said he would. He was supposed to win by 5 or 6 points. He won by only, I think, 1.6 points. And so, therefore, Buttigieg is pretty strong.
But wait a minute, Dan. I gotta stop you there, because one of the things that I think is missing from your statement, particularly when you compare, because the comparison was to 2016 when he beat Hillary Clinton by 40 points. That was a two-person race, whereas in New Hampshire this time, if you add a write-in vote for Bloomberg, there were 11 people in this race.
Yeah, I agree. But polls, that's
an important point. When you say he didn't perform as well this time, it's a different field this time, and the standards are different.
No, I wasn't comparing his performance to that of 2016. I was
okay.
I was just comparing his performance to the polls that immediately preceding the primary vote, and he was supposed to win by 5 or 6 points. He won by 1.6 points, and therefore it's still a horse race. There's still, as you say, there are still many people in this race. Sanders is undoubtedly the front runner, but there are others who are still strong as well. Buttigieg, most notably. Biden is fading dramatically. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, he's already out of the race. But Bloomberg is suddenly gaining in the polls, and Klobuchar is not doing badly as well. So all I'm saying is that the horse race will continue, the pack will continue racing ahead for a few more weeks until things clarify themselves. I expect Sanders to emerge the strongest possible candidate in the race, and that going into the summer, he will be in the lead. Whether he has a nomination sewn up is a different story. I just want to make a point about the Democrats, if I may. Mm-hmm. I mean, Sanders is some kind of socialist. Whether he's a social democrat or a socialist, period or not, we could just debate at great length. But there's no debate that the Democratic Party is not a socialist party. I mean, the Democratic Party is so bourgeois it might as well be listed on the New York Stock Exchange. and when you call upon the Democrats, not to be afraid of the S word and to explain clearly what it means, the Democratic Party never explains anything. Mm-hmm. It stands for nothing. Mm-hmm. It is a coterie of self-interested politicians. Period. The last year or two has distinguished itself by running a hysterical anti-Russian campaign, mounting an impeachment effort which fell flat on its face, and now it's panicking over the prospect of a Sanders nomination. So essentially, Sanders is a socialist trying to take over a non-socialist party and somehow bring it to heel, and I think it's kind of a very unusual task he's set for himself. And whether he can pull it off is not quite clear. And the party may revolt against Sanders, and Sanders may find himself, really denied the nomination as we head into the summer. So I think that Sanders is facing a very rocky road over the next few months. I do expect him to emerge as the popular favorite, but the party is not happy. And the party is increasingly uneasy at the prospect of Sanders heading up a ticket that is otherwise composed, of scores upon scores of local politicians who stand for nothing, believe nothing, except their own self-advancement.
And in defense of myself, I think I did preface my statement by saying, if the Democratic Party could develop a message and if they, in fact, could stay on message. I think that's what I prefaced it with. So I agree with you 1,000%. Final points on this to both Linwood and to Jim, and I'm coming to Linwood with this first. In terms of going into South Carolina, two things. One, now it seems everybody's saying that, Joe Biden, if he can resurrect himself in South Carolina, the numbers are showing that's becoming increasingly more difficult for him to do. And the other thing is Bloomberg in ads with former President Obama, as though that's supposed to resonate within the community. I'm not seeing it. Linwood, your thoughts on both?
Well, I think the Bloomberg is obviously the foe that Biden has to be most concerned with. Biden has hung his candidacy, particularly with his two losses and some losses coming in the future, on South Carolina. His campaign is even using the term firewall, that the black community is Joe Biden's firewall. This is the same terminology that Hillary Clinton used. And of course, she did not get enthusiastic support from the black community because she has a record that mitigates against that. And as Biden's record in terms of his support for various policies that were detrimental to the black community, as that comes to the fore, he's losing votes. As unendorsed endorsement by Barack Obama of Bloomberg comes, people have to wonder why didn't Obama endorse Biden? And so that's a slap to Biden. The problem is, of course, that Bloomberg has his own baggage, which is only beginning to emerge on the national scene. Folks in New York knew about Biden's racism. Bloomberg's.
But Linwood, he apologized. Come on now. He apologized. And we're supposed to be loving, forgiving people, whether you're Christian, whether you're Muslim, you're supposed to be forgiving. So come on, Linwood.
Yes, yes. I do think that, that older voters have that same attitude. I don't think younger voters have that attitude. And so, you know, to apologize when it's convenient, you're running a campaign, and so you're apologizing, is one thing. But there's continuing to be audio and video of him in various speeches and other contexts and saying things that were absolutely racist. And I don't think younger voters are going to apologize. And I do think there's a phenomena with younger voters becoming active in politics is that younger voters will have a greater influence on older voters than older voters will have on younger voters. Because grandma understands that that granddaughter is the future. And if she's not for a candidate or if she's for a candidate, the grandma might be more convinced than the other way around. And so the fact that you have, I guess, what's called cancel culture among the younger folks means you can't apologize. you have to live with your statements, with your past, and we go on to someone else who doesn't have to apologize.
Jim Kavanaugh, to Linwood's point, I think the Biden support in South Carolina within the Black community is going to be generational, to his point. And I also believe that when you talk about the stop and frisk program that Bloomberg is trying to support and now apologize for, and then you move to redlining, the basis of stop and frisk is racial profiling. The basis of redlining is economic racial profiling. So to me, we're seeing a continuum of thought, which is Bloomberg is a racist.
Yeah, I just, again, it goes to whether or not these things get repeated and repeated by the mainstream press. The evidence here is just overwhelming, you know, and Bloomberg's apologies are no more, you know, it's a question of how sincere they are and how authentic it is. You know, this is like Biden saying, I really was against the Iraq war the minute after I voted for it. The record shows he's not. But Bloomberg's trying to say, oh, I tried to reduce stop and frisk. Baloney. He was bragging about it 3 and 4 years after he left office. The redlining, these are all right-wing talking points, every one of them, the racial profiling for the stop and frisk, the right-wing talking points about redlining because, you know, they gave the Congress forced banks to give the economic crisis occurred because Congress forced banks to give loans in minority neighborhoods that they didn't give before. That's what caused this is all baloney. And, you know, I got to say that these things are not being promoted, they're being shown repetitively by the mainstream press, that the Democratic Party is opening itself up and begging Bloomberg to come in. Bloomberg ran what was essentially a Jim Crow policy with the army of New York police, as he calls them, this police army in New York. And that's what it was. And he says it explicitly. And the idea now that anybody who claims they're any Democrat who comes out and says, we got to get rid of Trump, and I'm really anti-Trump because Trump's such a racist. Excuse me. Bloomberg is the much more effective racist than Trump. He ran, a Jim Crow policy. Trump put an ad in the paper saying if the Central Park Five are guilty, they should be, you know, executed or something. Bloomberg, after they were found innocent, spent year or 2 years withholding the award that they got in the courts. He refused to pay it. So this guy is, you know, nobody can claim, no Democrat or anybody who votes for Trump, who says I'm not going to vote for Trump because he's a racist, and then votes for Bloomberg, has any credibility about that.
In fact, real quick on this, and then we'll move to the issue with Syria. The reason I said Bloomberg was a racist is because I subscribe to the definition of racist as someone that's a bigot, such as Donald Trump, that had the institutional wherewithal to implement their bigotry. It's the systemic ability to impose your bigotry on those who you are bigoted towards that makes you a racist. That, to me, is the definition. So, yeah, Trump at that time was a bigot, not a racist. As you said, he was able to take out an ad, but that ad did not enable Donald Trump to systematically impose his bigotry on the Central Park Seven. U.S. troops open fire on locals in northeast Syria. Daniel Lazar, what does this tell you?
it tells us a great deal. It tells us, number one, the U.S. has no idea what it's doing in Syria. It's just there because, you know, because Donald Trump, you know, can't, is under congressional pressure to keep them there, somehow show a commitment to occupying the oil fields of eastern Syria, number one. But number two, it also shows how Syria itself is beset by so many armies. I mean, I think in the last week, Syria essentially has fought against six armies: Israel, Turkey, the rebel forces backed by the Gulf states, the U.S. Army, and others. This is a battleground that is totally confused. No one knows what's going on there. And the U.S. Doesn't know what it's doing there. And most importantly, an innocent Syrian got killed. Now, if an American got killed, that's, you know, that's a stop the presses moment. But, you know, but if a Syrian gets killed by U.S. troops, no one even notices. But this is, of course, outrageous. And the U.S. has just no idea what it's doing there. It's just looking for trouble. It's begging for trouble.
Linwood, same thing to you, particularly with President Trump saying, we're here to take the oil and we're going to take it.
Exactly. And this innocent Syrian being killed, this person has family. They have kinship with many others. And I don't expect that they're simply going to sit back and allow this to happen, and that there will be some retribution for this. Now, this is the beginning of a insurgency, if you will. The question that Daniel raises, though, is who are you an insurgent against? There's so many forces in Syria, but it's clear that the U.S. military was responsible for this death. And, you know, just like the Iraqis are demanding that the American troops, U.S. troops, get out of Iraq, and that demand is not going to go away. The U.S., of course, can stay. They can impose their will. But you can expect some insurgency to rise as a result of that. And the same in Syria is what I'm expecting.
Jim Kavanaugh.
Yeah, well, this is extremely dangerous. It's part of the whole neocon effort, which is directed against Iran and Syria. And what they're trying to do now is to prevent the Syrian government and the Syrian army from retaking Idlib province, which it is in the process of doing. Turkey wants to prevent them from doing that. Turkey is sending in heavy weapons, tanks, and the United States, I'm sure, Pompeo and or Esper, I forget which, flew off to Turkey to talk with Erdogan about this. They're egging the Turks on to confront the Syrian army in Idlib. In the meantime, what's happened in these instances at these checkpoints were that the United States Army is coming out of the areas in the west where they're supposedly there for the oil. It's not about the oil. They're coming out of those areas and trying to move back in and extend their footprint, and they're running into Syrian checkpoints, Syrian army checkpoints, and popular with people on them, and they're not allowing them to cross into these areas. And that's where this fighting is beginning. So the United States is pushing to extend its footprint in Syria. It's all pressure on the Syrian government to try to prevent them from retaking their own territory. There's a very big danger of a fight between Syria and Turkey, Syrian Arab Army and the Turkish Army, which would involve the Russians. I think the United States, the neocons in the U.S. want that to happen. I think Donald Trump doesn't have a clue about this. He thinks it's about the oil. It's not. It's about trying to get rid of the government of Syria still. And the neocon forces that are pressuring him are, you know, he's now given people command to take decisions without asking him against Iran and against forces. And I think people like Pompeo and Esper are egging Erdogan on and are telling the commanders of the American forces in the West to push east and to try and break through these Syrian checkpoints. You know, do it carefully at the beginning, but make our presence felt and make that pressure felt. It's a very dangerous situation.
And wrapping this up, Daniel Lazar, and following up to what Jim just said about Erdogan said on Wednesday that Turkey will attack Syrian government forces anywhere in Syria if another Turkish soldier is hurt. And we had, at one point, the Sochi ceasefire back in 2018. So how do you see Turkey playing all of this out relative to Russian involvement?
Well, I mean, Erdogan to me is really another desperate man. I mean, his economy is collapsing. His political support at home is evaporating. He seems to be seized by these neo-Ottoman fantasies about reasserting Turkish influence throughout the Middle East and even into North Africa via Libya, where he's inserting himself. But he's a military adventurist, hoping to score a big win, which will somehow shore up support at home. But it never works that way. And it's not working that way in Idlib province either. I mean, the Syrian Arab army is advancing. The Turks are coming under heavy bombardment. I mean, Erdogan may talk about reinforcing his presence there and going on the offensive against Syria. But to what end? I mean, he'll get bogged down to a deeper war, and it's not going to do him any good. I mean, Idlib is a mountainous province. It's a tough battleground. He's not going to fare well, and this whole adventurous policy is going to eventually collapse around him. And Russia is engaged in a very delicate dance. I mean, it's trying to sort of appease all sides, from Turkey and Syria and Israel as well, and Iran too. And it's just trying to stay out of trouble while somehow buttressing the Syrian regime. But the strategy is not working because the situation in Syria seems to be rapidly disintegrating. And it seems that another round of more serious warfare is brewing. And so we'll see what happens.
That's the voice of Daniel Lazar. We were also joined by Dr. Linwood Taheed and Jim Kavanaugh. As always, gentlemen, thank you for your time. Really appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out!